place of rattling, right? Mm-hmm. And then is the order in which the peas then form themselves, is that systematic or orderly?
No.
It's the opposite, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the opposite of orderly. It's random, isn't it?
Yeah.
When the peas, you're shelling them, let's say, you're shelling them into a, or maybe your husband is, right, if he's a good husband like me. How many times have I done that, Annie, in the last 10 years?
Just enough to understand the call.
Just enough. the peas that fall
That's
into
That's why you're
the,
not really getting, you're not really eliciting the response, because I don't think you really understand about shelling.
Yes, I do. When the peas are taken out of the pods and you are putting them in there, getting them preparatory to boiling them, heating them, cooking them, what you have, it seems to me, when you as you shell them is a pretty random order of those peas. That makes sense?
Yep.
So this is the homely metaphor that Emily Dickinson is using. So what is it that she's saying, do you think? Going back to these seven words.
Would you repeat the seven words again, please?
Sure.
I can't read them.
It's a little hard to read, right. I realize that. This is not a very good system. Revolution is the pod systems rattle from. Now, given the process then of preparing these peas by shelling them into a pan and having them rattle as they fall into the pan and forming a random pattern so that you could never pick one pea and say, that's the one that I want to be at the very center of the bottom or at the very tippity top so it's the first one that comes out. What is she saying then about revolution? What's this got to do with revolution?
Brings change.
In what fashion does it bring change?
Disorderly fashion.
Disorderly fashion. Unpredictable fashion. Random fashion. So what then is that, what kind of a political observation is this?
No, I don't know, she's trying to say that in a revolution you never know what's going to happen.
Exactly.
What kind of a system we're going to have.
Exactly. You never know what's going to result. History shows that if you want to predict what's going to come, you bring about change in some way other than a revolution. Now, Americans are spoiled. We are spoiled, you and I, because in our revolution, extraordinarily, miraculously, the resulting system was somewhere near what those revolutionaries predicted it should be. Their major goal was to get out from the tyranny, as they saw it, of Great Britain. But they also had in mind some of the things such as liberty and justice and individual freedom, which indeed did result. But one of the things that we don't realize, because we've had this experience, and that's what we think of as revolution, that was a miracle in history. It was particularly a miracle in a revolution of a colonial people rebelling, revolting against a tyrannical central government. It was the first since Christ that had occurred that way. And we don't realize what a miracle it was. But most revolutions, if you think about revolutions that you've known about, result in chaos. Annie and I have lived in Spanish America a lot. What happens in their revolutions is not what people who start the revolution might predict would happen. It's random. It may or it may not be better. It may be further right. It may be further left. It may be further center. It may be anything, but it's not predictable. So how long have I been talking now? Eloquently? 10 minutes? The lady said it in 7 words. She's a miracle. Now, how did she know that? How did she know so much? A recluse, a woman who never left her room after the age of 30 and a little more, whose exposure to the world and the world of affairs was a nil, who lived through the Civil War and never wrote a poem about it.
It wasn't nil.
Well, it was practically nil in the sense of the world of affairs.
Well, she lived in a home which was a hub for the affairs of that community, and the affairs of that community were not without significance in the nation.
Your father was a congressman, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, we tend to think of people who lived before us as living in great isolation and living in sort of states of innocent ignorance. But she was a great reader. She'd had a wonderful education. Probably more, had read more great books with just her high school education and 1 year of college than most of our MA graduates now. And she was, of course, much closer in time to that event, and it was part of the life of the town in which she lived.
You see why I can never get away with any of these dogmatic theories?
We should not holler at each other.
I also think that her isolated life must have given her time to do all this thinking. She wasn't concerned about freezing food for the next week, or how many children would be home from school to eat, or how many lunches I need to pack for tomorrow. It takes a lot of that clutter out of your brain. So maybe she had time to meditate and do this.
No telling what might happen to any of us if we take 8 or 10 months as a recluse.
That's right.
That's what Thoreau did in Walden, wasn't it?
Pithy, evocative essays. Yeah, that's true.
And that's part. That's a point that's made by it's just gone out of my mind. An American poet, woman. Come back, but that's her contention that Emily Dickinson simply made a choice to be a poet. Adrienne Rich. Mm-hmm. Adrienne Rich, having lived the life of a wife and mother of 3 or 4 sons, you know, had a very busy time and always having trouble finding time to write the poems. She said she thought Emily Dickinson just decided to be a poet.
There's a lot of evidence for that too, in her letters, in her poems, that it was kind of a decision. And when we make so much of that decision, by the way, and there's lots of books written about it, some of these books that you're sharing, are full of conjecture about how in the world did she decide to become a recluse and what went into that decision. Her sister, Lavinia, however, with wonderful, pithy New England taciturnity, said, with respect to why Emily had become a recluse, it was just to happen. Isn't that a good sister's remark?
Basically.
Don't romanticize my sister. She just decided to stay alone. It was just a habit.
Was she feeling well?
She was fine. Yeah, she didn't have health problems that would have caused this. She had some problems with her eyes. She died at 56 of Bright's disease. But most of her life had been quite healthy. She was not a robust, strong person. Physically, she was petite. But she was not ill. No, she wasn't ill.
Was Lavinia an outgoing person?
Not very. More outgoing than Emily, but that's not saying much. She never married either.
Was that the sister?
Yeah. Sister Lavinia, yeah. Huh? So they were very close after the parents died and the brother had moved next door, married a woman and lived next door. But the sisters were extremely close, although they were very, very different. To the point where, picture if you will, Lavinia didn't even know that Emily was a serious poet. And was astounded when she went into Emily's room after Emily had died and found in little fascicles sewn together in a bureau, tidy, the 1,775 poems, or almost all of them, and was amazed and couldn't understand them, only knew that they were something special and should be published. That was her perception, her aperçu, her amazingly, amazingly observant sense. And it was she then who doggedly pursued their being published until they were, indeed.
Did she publish some of her own life?
There were seven poems that were published. Some of them were changed when they were published, which infuriated Emily. She published them in the Springfield Republican, the newspaper in the next big town. But she was like a moth around a light bulb about being published and wasn't very satisfied with what happened and said, "I'm nobody, who are you? And I think I'll turn away from that and I won't be a frog sounding my name the livelong day to an admiring bog." Heck for that. Well, we should read some of them.
Yes.
We should read some.
We should have readings by people that we were with yesterday who put together some.
Yes. And I was to share the reading of A Day Help Help Another Day. Who was going to read that? You were going to read that, sir. Would you like to read it as you see it, and then I'll read it as I see it? And
A Day Help Help Another Day. Your prayers, old passerby, from such a common ball as this might date a victory. From marshalings as simple, the flags of nations swing. Steady, my soul. What issues upon thine arrow hang?
A day! Help, help, another day! Your prayers, O passers-by, from such a common ball as this might date a victory. From marshalings as simple, the flags of nations swang. Steady, my soul, what issues upon thine arrow hang?
It's interesting, because it's so much fun to try different approaches to the same words. What's your name?
Don.
Don. May I ask you to go up and sit there, because we can't see you here.
Oh.
I'm a theater person. I worry about lights and sets. We can't see your face there. The light's a little bit better here, because we get some coming at you rather than...
And we want you to say it the same way we eat it.
I beg your pardon?
We want him to say it the same way we eat it.
No. We want him to say it his own way.
Oh, yeah.
Which is differently. Because you don't see it as this exuberant, hopeful poem, do you?
Well, no.
Yeah.
I can see that. You know, I can see it can be taken different ways.
Yeah.
When I first read it, I didn't see it the way he saw it.
Right. So, I'd like to have you read it again, but read it with your own interpretation.
Okay.
Of its being a much bitterer sort of comment, right?
Yeah.
Ironical kind of.
Yeah.
A day.
Give us time, and okay. let us take it in.
Okay.
It'll be easier to understand you now if people can see your face.
A day. Help, help, another day. Your prayers, O passerby, from such a common ball as this might date a victory. From marshalings as simple, the flags of nations swang. Steady, my soul. What issues upon thine arrow hang?
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's really interesting how differently it can be interpreted.
Either way, I don't get it.
Think of it as a dawn poem. Think of it these days. Think of this day when you first got up this morning and looked out and saw another of these booming, as Emily called them, booming days. And she just is, in my interpretation now, uh-huh. Let me try this, it is kind of overwhelmed by the splendor of it. Think of it further, and this is not necessarily the way it came about, but it might very well have. She was in Boston from Amherst having her eyes tended to, and she had to keep them closed and covered, and she couldn't read. And so then she came back to Amherst, and her reaction to nature as she saw it was, what a miraculous world this is. And I'd forgotten, because I had to keep my eyes covered, what a great thing sight is.
Was that the background of the poem?
No, it's not specifically, but it might very well be. Yeah, that she wrote some poems in response to that experience.
I was just wondering if that was the background of the poem, because I seem to get that other feeling that help, you know, this is about the help.
Yeah, your prayers. Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit, Don, about your approach to it, which is different?
Well, I guess we all have days when we get up and go, what the hell is going to happen today? The help thing kind of makes me think that way.
Mm-hmm.
It might not be such a great day.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest just sort of follows that kind of approach. At least the way I took it.
Yeah. But do you want to read it once more, Don?
What's this ball?
Let's take it line by line. Let's just take it line by line first, so we've got all the words. Why doesn't Don read it, and we'll talk about it. Just read it with the first line.
A day. Help. Help. Another day.
That's quick.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Another day.
Your prayers, old passerby.
Uh-huh. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, that's almost...
What you pray for?
Anybody.
Yeah.
Pray for me. Anybody going by?
From such a common ball as this, I guess common day, I suppose.
Me? Common? My God, my person?
Well, common day, I think they meant.
I think a ball as the sun moving, making the day.
Oh. Let's get the whole line.
From such a common ball as this might date a victory.
Okay.
But would the ball mean the world itself?
Yeah, the globe.
I don't know. I think it would just refer to the day, whichever way you want to say, whether you're talking about the earth or the sun or the moon.
Or the earth, right. But I think it does refer to this day.
To the universe.
Yeah.
The outer world of this day.
I don't see where they get day out of ball.
You think of the ball as being like a clock, a circle.
I thought of it as the sun, because the sun moves apparently. To our appearances, moves around and starts to come up here. What we see it is coming up, over there, and then it passes over here. So that ball represents the visible day to her. That's my interpretation, but there are certainly others possible.
Tom, I hate to undercut you there, but I took it as a dance.
Is it what?
As a dance, as a chance, a ball, as a dance.
Wow!
Yeah.
Here we go.
Wow.
Let's go to the ball.
Could be.
Uh-huh.
Well, read it again now and see if that fits. The language.
From such a common ball as this might date a victory.
Is there any way of timekeeping where there's a ball that falls in the course of a day?
Yeah, museum. In planetariums.
Don't think she would necessarily have one, though.
No.
But
she had trouble with time. Her father taught her to tell time when she was a little girl, and she didn't learn.
Ooh.
And she was so embarrassed, she never told anybody. So she developed all sorts of stratagems for knowing what time it was.
She was 17 or 18,
she did learn. But it's a very interesting thing to think of, partly what a curmudgeon she considered her father to be, how much she felt she had to please him and get it when he taught her, and then how inventive she was to live with this sort of blind spot. I mean, we all have things we compensate for, though. That's a really interesting one. So her, you know, her concept of time, maybe her imagery, maybe kind of unique.
Well, I like your idea of a ball passing time. I remember a clock we had in our house way back in my grandmother's house. You had weights.
Yeah.
That made the clock run, and you wound the clock up by pulling the weight up at the beginning of the day or at night, and then during the day the weight would come down.
Yeah.
And so the weight could be in the form of a ball or a cylinder or a clock.
So there are lots of choices.
So the passage of time.
The passage of time.
Yeah, but they're all wrong.
Common ball.
They're all wrong except the sun. The sun obviously is the ball that's talked about, and we talk about this day. The ball comes up over there, it moves. When it's here, it's midday. When it gets over there, it's time for vespers, and that's it.
Right. This is our good. It is sitting in our darkened room. Darkened all the window, not seeing as I'm watching the ball of the clock.
tortured interpretations.
Next line.
By such a common ball as this, my date of victory. See, what could be?
Yeah,
this was
date
after the Civil War, and victory is the to hear of a victory at Shiloh or Gettysburg or wherever was a tremendous event, and it might happen on a day like this.
No, this is just maybe, perhaps, a little victory
might,
in our lives.
Might,
our lives.
Yes. That would make the day. This day is worthy of a victory. This day is worthy of a victory.
A victory ball?
you're just supporting your husband. Not my thesis.
The dancing cakes.
So from marshallings as simple, the flags of nations swang. So what are the marshallings?
The gathering of the army.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Marshall, they would be, of course, but in terms of this day that she's talking about, what would the marshallings be?
I think only Emily might know.
What date did she write the poem?
I'm not sure. It's in the book that you have, but...
The beginnings of the day.
Sure, I think they're the beginnings of the day. Again, take it as a dawn. I've always thought of this as a dawn.
A day.
She goes out and she looks, and the swallows are starting to marshal over this very edifice. The shadows are starting to change as the sun comes up, and more of the village is in sunlight instead of shadow. The manifestations of the human race are starting to be seen with the smoke coming out of the kitchen chimney. We hear other beings start to make noises. The ground squirrels are starting to scamper around the village, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to me this is the marshallings of the day. The
smell of cotton being
brewed. There you go.
Well,
people going in.
Marshallings as simple. Might date from marshallings as simple. The flags of nations swang. A day like this, with all its splendor and beauty and uniqueness, the flags of nations have been visible.
Yeah.
This is a day when you want to fly your flag. This is the day.
Unless you hit the might. And then if you hit the might, you get an entirely different interpretation.
For marshallings as simple, the flags of nations might swing, you mean? Might swing?
Might.
Yeah.
Could be. Sounded.
And then I think the last two lines, in my interpretation, steady my soul, what issues upon thine arrow hang. I almost can't take this in. This is such a marvelous experience to wake and look out and see this day. Anything could happen on a day like this. What issues upon thine arrow hang. Thine arrow being, again, I think, a manifestation of time, the arrow of the clock moving around. Perhaps.
Well, yeah.
Could be. So anything could happen on a day like today.
But the arrow is the soul, right?
The arrow could be destiny. If the archer shoots the arrow and he lets it go and off,
And it arches too through the sky, but
kind of what,
he can't control it once he lets it go.
Mm-hmm.
So the what issues hang upon the arrow?
What,
and where's he going to aim? And then he lets it go.
Yeah, what's going to happen with my...
So what is that last line?
Steady my soul, what issues upon thine arrow hang! Exclamation point.
Is that the end?
Yeah.
And what is the date of it?
1858.
1858, so it's before the Civil War.
Yes. Okay. Let's just have you both read it again. And Don, do you want to read it to Tom and try to try to get him to grow up and not have this ridiculous, optimistic, childish euphoria?
You have to drop that all the time.
All the time.
Help, help, another day. Your prayers, old passerby. From such a common ball as this might date a victory, from marshallings as simple the flags of nations swang. Steady, my soul, what issues upon thine arrow's hang?
Present your case, Tom.
I see the day coming through there. A day! Help, help, another day! Your prayers, O passers-by, from such a common ball as this might date a victory. For marshallings as simple, the flags of nations swang. Oh, steady, my soul, what issues upon thine arrow hang?
I like this interpretation better.
And the trick to doing this kind of stuff is, once you've got an idea and an image and an approach to it, stick to it. And the more you can actually imagine the pictures in your mind, you know, if you actually see that arrow going, the clearer it is to us. I mean, it really works. That if you actually visualize these things you're talking about, we will understand it much more clearly. You will convey that image to us. So that's important.
What is there some ancient Greek or Egyptian god or someone, it's just very faint in my mind, but that shot an arrow, the god of the sun, he shot the arrow across the sky. Did anyone remember anything about that?
Well, it's
shot an arrow into the air, where landed, I know not where.
It fell to the earth, I know not where.
Was it Apollo? He had his chariot, though, didn't he? There's the sun god Re, R-E, an Egyptian. Did he shoot an arrow, or was it somebody else?
Icarus?
He didn't shoot an arrow.
Icarus went himself. Icarus was the one who got too close to the sun and burned.
Egyptian sun god.
But did he shoot an arrow first?
I don't know that he shot an arrow first. What he did was to construct wings. He had wings. He built wings.
He had built, made wings.
He built, right. And then he went up and he flew so close to the sun that they melted.
Because
and he fell to earth.
His father was?
His father?
Tradians with a D.
Daedalus?
Daedalus?
His father actually...
Their father and son, The son had made his of wax, so
Because the father did this trick every day with the son.
The father was able to do it. Was it Daedalus? I think it was Daedalus.
And then his son tried it and died. The wax melted and he fell to the earth.
The sense that he got carried away. He got inflated and he flew, you know, too close to the sun. He didn't keep his sense about him to stay down lower.
Might have started out saying, a day, help, help, and took off.
What's next?
Do we still have Robert? Mm-hmm. We want to use Robert while we've got him, so he does, before he escapes to his daughters.
Yes.
Yes.
Robert, you were to read with whom? What was the one?
We were to read together.
Yeah. Okay, why don't you come on up here?
We haven't practiced.
That's come on up here so we can...
Okay. I was just getting into this day thing.
So, for a change of pace, we have two death poems.
You want both at the same time, or...?
Yeah.
Why don't you come on up here so you both... Yeah, so we get them both together.
There is a languor of the life, more imminent than pain. 'Tis pain's successor when the soul has suffered all it can. A drowsiness diffuses. A dimness like a fog envelops consciousness, as mists obliterate a crag. The surgeon does not blanch at pain. His habit is severe. But tell him that it ceased to feel the creature lying there. And he will tell you skill is late, a mightier than he has ministered before him. There is no vitality.
I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air, between the heaves of the storm. The eyes round had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering firm for the last onset. And the king be witnessed in the room. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portion of me be assignable, and then it was there interposed a fly with blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me. And then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see. To see.
Interesting together. They're really interesting together because the first one is almost an abstract picture of death, except the that wonderfully acerb comment about the surgeon. Mm. The surgeon does not feel the pain. And then it just gets more and more specific down to this little fly. It's really interesting.
There goes this image of the last thing you see in this life is this silly little fly.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing so like floating above.
That was the moment I died, just in the
it was to be an exalted moment, and it turned out to be really an anticlimax.
You left glimmerings of sight with this buzzing fly.
Yeah. Homely. She loved homely images that kind of brought things down to earth. What impressed me was that I felt that both of these readers really had a clear idea of the meaning of the words, and therefore they communicated them to us, even though maybe there was a line or two or a word here and there that we weren't quite sure why that word was there. Still, there was a thrust through both of the poems that reflected their understanding, which picks up your point, Annie, that if you have an idea about the understanding of it, as you read it, it tends to make it communicable in a way that nothing else can do.
Another device when reading poetry or anything that has a lot of metaphor or poetic parts of speech is to imagine that the people to whom you're speaking have another language as their first language. They understand English,
We read English well, but it may not be the easiest language for them to take in through their ears. And you, if you think that way, you just sort of help to get the meaning across. And one other device that I'd like to have both of you try, and this is speech, this is voice, not speech, but I still think it's helpful. Imagine when you're speaking that there is a vessel into which, into which you want the words to go. And then you just put that vessel beyond the furthest listener. Actually, what we'll do is we're going to put one here and one here. And this is an exercise you can really do to just improve your own projection, because it happens automatically. If you think of getting your voice into the cup, it will just get there and your body will do all the right things. And you can actually improve your own projection by moving the cup further and further away from yourself, and you'll get so that your voice will just carry further and further. It just gets you up and out. It's the voice up and out. So should we try both of those poems again? Mm-hmm. They both merit more than one hearing. So get your voices into the cups.
There is a languor of the life more imminent than pain. 'Tis pain's successor when the soul has suffered all it can. A drowsiness diffuses, a dimness like a fog envelops consciousness, as mists obliterate a crag. The surgeon does not blanch at pain, his habit is severe, but tell him that it ceased to feel the creature lying there. And he will tell you, skill is late, a mightier than he has ministered before him. There's no vitality.
You're the flying buzzing around here.
No. We provide everything.
All the props.
Say your prayers.
How do you feel?
Yeah, that was wonderful. But that had a real clarity. I got every thought.
Excellent.
I think it was really wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His accent really.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Helps too.
Yes.
I mean, it really has a nice resonance.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gives it a sonority. Imagine that we're primarily all German speakers.
I heard a fly buzz. I'm going to start over again.
That's fine.
I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering firm for that last onset when the king be witnessed in the room. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portion of me be assignable, and then it was there interposed a fly. With blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me. And then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That was marvelous. It was funnier
And
yeah, a little more irony.
Yeah, a little more irony, right? Yeah. Yeah, really nice. And what you did there when you went back was also a very important thing in reading poetry or any other kind of performance out loud. You started out without keeping in mind, without having in mind where the sentence was going. And you have to know where the sentence is going, because we don't start to talk unless we know where we're going. We do take pauses when we talk, but when we start a sentence, we know where we're headed. And so when you start phrase...
I was concentrating on projecting my voice.
Yes, yeah.
I did a much better job of that, too, by the way.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Did a much better job of that, too.
You both did. Uh-huh. Yeah, really interesting.
Is she saying that the mourners were all standing around?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But then who is the king?
Who's the king?
Green Reaper.
The Lord. Well, Lord. Why don't we just go around the room and come up with ideas for the king?
I think you weren't with us yesterday. Perhaps, were you with us when we talked about this as a 19th century pattern of people coming to the deathbed, friends, family, the minister, to see the momentous event of death taking place, and seeing how the deceased, the dying one, reacted. Did she look okay? Did she look happy? No, she looked pretty grim. Oh, I knew that there was something wrong with the way that woman lived. So when I said this, Verlon Brown said, "So you have to be a hypocrite even on your deathbed, eh?" And that's right. That was the point in 19th century New England towns. You had to put up that front at every moment to show that you were saved, that you were an upright person. And the hypocrisy of that, when people lived their normal sinful lives, drove her from the church, in effect. So even on the deathbed, you've got to behave right. When the king, lots of different interpretations, but certainly it relates to death. This would be the place where God would come to take over.
Would it be so the final judge?
The final judge, and maybe, heaven forfend, Beelzebub himself? Maybe?
What's that line about eyes? That people looking at it, would you read that line again?
The final line.
When the eyes are round?
The eyes round.
Yes.
Yeah, what is that one?
The eyes of round. The eyes are round.
The eyes are round, and then what is it? Where's it go?
And then it had wrung them dry. There's dash.
Oh, they've been crying their eyes
out?
They're finished with the crying.
Okay,
had wrung them dry.
They're just waiting.
So they, yeah.
But that also, you see, takes upon a kind of a ritualistic routine. Okay, now here we are, and poor Mabel is going to die, and we have to show that we're weeping a little bit. Now, okay, we've got over that. Now let's get on with the main act. Huh? That's the curtain raiser. Now let's get on with the main act. When is the king coming into the room? And the king doesn't come into the room. What comes into the room instead is dirty little nasty blowfly.
That's only for the person who's dying.
I saw the fly. I was there, and I saw that doggone fly come into that room. I think it was disgraceful.
Now wait a minute. I have another interpretation for that fly.
Okay.
Here we are in this room, and she's dying, and the people they've used up all their tears, and nobody's saying anything, and it's so quiet in that room, and they're just waiting for her to die. Here comes something lively. It's alive. It's alive. It's something that is not dying. It's not crying. It's delighting her. And I thought of this because I heard of a man who lived alone in a room in a nursing home or someplace, and he was very, very lonely. And if a fly would come into the room, was his friend. and he wouldn't let anyone kill it, you know, because here was something alive, he could talk to it. And I thought of this poem today when I was hiking back from the Holden Lake Trail by myself, and I sat down, and there were no chipmunks or anything to keep me company, and I didn't have my gloves on, I had just my... And a fly came, and you know, if you let them land, all we want is just a little bit of moisture, a little bit of salty water from your on you. And so here was this fly, so we just sat there for several minutes and enjoyed each other, and then a little tiny fly, the kind I've never seen before, and it came, and it had the cutest little wings, and it was here, and it was getting its little drink. Where's all the bugs?
And would you read the poem that way? Just read it. That's great. Just, you know, all that.
Okay.
And you can have all those wonderful images.
I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of a storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, the breaths were gathering firm for the last onset when the king be witnessed in the room. I willed my keepsake, signed away what portion may be assignable, and that was, there interposed a fly. With blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me. And then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see.
I think we have to see the video, and we'll do the other poems the next time, but the video, which will tell us a lot about Emily Dickinson's life and about the setting of her life and about
can
some of the poems
come back
as well.
Who has more poems to do?
Yeah.
Okay.